From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
Ladies in Waiting by Hugh B. Cave. Halper, the village real estate man, said with a squint, "You're the same people looked at that place back in April, aren't you?" "Sure you are. The ones that got caught in that freak snowstorm and spent the night there. Mr. and Mrs. Wilkes, is it?" "Wilkins," Norman corrected, frowning at a photograph on the wall of the old man's dingy office, a yellowed, fly-spotted picture of the house itself and all its decay and drabness. "And you want to look at it again?" "Yes," Linda exclaimed. Both men looked at her sharply because of her vehemence. Norman, her husband, was alarmed anew by the eagerness that suddenly flamed in her lovely brown eyes, and as suddenly was replaced by a look of guilt. Yes, unmistakably a look of guilt. "I mean," she stammered, "we still want a big old house that we can do over, Mr. Halper. We've never stopped looking, and we keep thinking the Creighton place just might do." "You keep thinking it might do," Norman silently corrected. He himself had intensely disliked the place when Halper showed it to them 4 months ago. The sharp edge of his abhorrence was not even blunted, and time would never dull his remembrance of that shocking expression on Linda's face. When he stepped through the 170-year-old doorway again, he would hate and fear the house as much as before, he was certain. Would he again see that look on his wife's face? God forbid. "Well," Halper said, "there's no need for me to go along with you this time, I guess. I'll just ask you to return the key upon your return, same as you did before." Norman accepted the tagged key from him and walked unhappily out to the car. It was 4 miles from the village to the house, 1 mile of narrow blacktop, three of a dirt road that seemed forlorn and forgotten even in this neglected part of New England. At 3 p.m. of an awesomely hot August day, the car made the only sound in a deep green silence. The sun's heat had robbed even birds and insects of their voices. Norman was silent too, with apprehension. Beside him, his adored wife of less than 2 years leaned forward to peer through the windshield for the first glimpse of their destination, seeming to have forgotten he existed. Only the house now mattered. And there it was. Nothing had changed. It was big and ugly, with a sagging front piazza and too few windows. It was old. It was gray because almost all its white paint had weathered away. According to old Halper, the Creightons had lived here for generations, having come here from Salem, where one of their women in the days of witchcraft madness had been hanged for practicing demonology. A likely story. As he stopped the car by the piazza steps, Norman glanced at the girl beside him, his beloved, his childhood sweetheart. Why in God's name was she eager to come here again? She had not been so in the beginning. For days after that harrowing ordeal, she had been depressed, unwilling even to talk about it. But then, weeks later, the change. Ah, yes, the change. So subtle at first, or at least as subtle as her unsophisticated nature could contrive. "Norm, do you remember that old house we were snowbound in? Do you suppose we might have liked it if things had been different?" Then not so subtle. "Norm, can we look at the Creighton place again, please, Norm?" As he fumbled the key into the lock, he reached her hand. "Are you all right, hon?" "Of course," the same tone of voice she had used in Halper's shabby office. Impatient, critical, Don't ask silly questions. With a premonition of disaster, he pushed the old door open. It was the same. Furnished, Halper had called it, trying to be facetious. There were dusty ruins of furniture and carpets, and yes, someone or something was using them, that the house had not been empty for 8 years, as Halper claimed. Now the feeling returned as Norman trailed his wife through the downstairs rooms and up the staircase to the bedchambers above. But the feeling was strong. He wanted desperately to seize her hand again and shout, "No, no, darling, come out of here!" Upstairs, when she halted in the big front bedroom, turning slowly to look around her, he said helplessly, "Hon, please, what is it? What do you want?" No answer. He had ceased to exist. She even bumped into him as she went past to sit on the old four-poster with its mildewed mattress, and seated there she stared emptily into space, as she had done before. He went to her and took her hands. "Linda, for God's sake, what is it with this place?" She looked up and smiled at him. "I'm all right. Don't worry, darling." There had been an old blanket on the bed when they entered this room before. He had thought of wrapping her in it because she was shivering. The house was frigid, and with the car trapped in deepening snow, they would have to spend the night here. But the blanket reeked with age, and she had cringed from the touch of it. Then, "Wait," he had said with a flash of inspiration. "Maybe if I could jam this under a tire. Come on, it's at least worth a try." "I'm cold, Norm. Let me stay here." "You'll be all right? Not scared?" "Better scared than frozen." "Well, I won't be long." How long was he gone? 10 minutes? 20? Twice the car had seemed about to pull free from the snow's mushy grip. Twice the wheel had spun the sodden blanket out from under and sent it flying through space like a huge yellow bird, and he'd been forced to go groping after it with the frigid wind lashing his half-frozen face. Say 20 minutes? Certainly no longer. Then, giving it up as a bad job, he had trudged despondently back to the house and climbed the stairs again to the front bedroom. And there she sat on the bed, as she was sitting now, white as the snow itself, wide-eyed, staring at or into something that only she could see. "Linda, what's wrong?" "Nothing, nothing." He grasped her shoulders. "Look at me. Stop staring like that. What happened?" "I thought I heard something. Saw something." "Saw what?" "I don't know. I don't remember." Lifting her from the bed, he put his arms about her and glowered defiantly at the empty doorway. Strange. A paper-thin layer of mist or smoke moved along the floor there, drifting out into the hall, and there were floating shapes of the same darkish stuff trapped in the room's corners, as though left behind when the chamber emptied itself of a larger mass. Or was he imagining these things? One moment they seemed to be there, a moment later they were gone. And was he also imagining the odor? It had not been present in the musty air of this room before. It certainly seemed to be now, unless the senses were playing tricks on him. A peculiarly robust smell, unquestionably male. But now it was fading. Never mind. There was someone in this house. By God, he had felt an alien presence when Halper was here, even more so after the agent's departure. Someone, something, following them about, watching them. The back of Linda's dress was unzipped, he realized then. His hands, pressing her to him, suddenly found themselves inside the garment on her body. And her body was cold. Colder than the snow he had struggled with outside. Cold and clammy. The zipper? He fumbled for it, found it drawn all the way down. What in God's name had she tried to do? This was his wife, who loved him. This was the girl who only a few weeks ago, at the clubs, had savagely slapped the face of the town's richest, handsomest playboy for daring to hint at a mate-swapping arrangement. Slowly, he drew the zipper up again, then held her at arm's length, and looked again at her face. She seemed unaware he had touched her, or that he even existed. She was entirely alone, still gazing into that secret world in which he had no place. The rest of that night had seemed endless. Linda lying on the bed, he sitting beside her, waiting for daylight. She seemed to sleep some of the time. At other times, though, she said nothing, even when spoken to. He sensed she was as wide awake as he. About 4 o'clock, the wind died and the snow stopped, its wet slapping of the window panes. No dawn had ever been more welcome, even though he was still unable to free the car, and they both had to walk to the village to send a tow truck for it. And now he had let her persuade him to come back here. He must be insane. Norman? She sat there on the bed, the same bed, but at least she was looking at him now, not through him into that secret world of hers. Norman, you do like this house a little, don't you? If you mean, could I ever seriously think of living here? Emphatically, he shook his head. My God, no. It gives me the horrors. It's really a lovely old house, Norman. We could work on it little by little. Do you think I'm crazy? If you can even imagine living in this mausoleum, I know you're crazy. My God, woman, you were nearly frightened out of your wits here. In this very room, too. Was I, Norman, really? Yes, you were. If I live to be 100, I'll never stop seeing that look on your face. What kind of look was it, Norman? I don't know. That's just it. I don't know. What in heaven's name were you seeing when I walked back in here after my session with a car? What was this mist, that smell? Smiling, she reached out for his hand. I don't remember any mist or smell, Norman. I was just a little frightened. I told you. I thought I heard something. You saw something, too. You said. Did I say that? I've forgotten. Still smiling, she looked around the room, at the garden of faded roses on shreds of time-stained wallpaper, at the shabby bureau with its solitary broken cut glass vase. Old Mr. Halper was to blame for what happened, Norman. His talk of demons. Halper didn't do that much talking, Linda. Well, he told us about the woman who was hanged in Salem. I can see now, of course, that he threw that out as bait, because I had told him you write mystery novels. He probably pictured you sitting in some sort of Dracula cape, scratching out your books with a quill by lamplight, and thought this would be a marvelous setting for it. Her soft laugh was a welcome sound, reminding Norman he loved this girl, and she loved him, that their life together, except for inexplicable interest in this house, was full of gentleness and caring. But he could not let her win with this debate. Linda, listen, if this is such a fine old house, why has it been empty for 8 years? Well, Mr. Halper explained that, Norman. Did he? I don't seem to recall any explanation. He said that last person to live here was a woman who died 8 years ago at 93. Her married name was Stanhope. I think he said, but she was a Creighton. She even had the same given name, Prudence, as the woman hanged in Salem for worshipping demons. And when she passed away, there was some legal question about the property because her husband had died some years before in an asylum, leaving no will. Norman reluctantly nodded. The truth was, he hadn't paid much attention to the real estate man's talk, but he did recall a remark that the last man of the house had been committed to an asylum for the insane, probably from having lived in such a gloomy old house for so long, he had thought at the time. Annoyed with himself for having lost the debate, at least for not having won it, he turned from the bed and walked to a window where he stood gazing down at the yard. Right down there, 4 months ago, was where he had struggled to free the car. Frowning at the spot now, he suddenly said aloud, "Wait, that's damn queer." "What is, dear?" Linda said from the bed. "I've always thought we left the car in a low spot that night. A spot where the snow must have drifted extra deep, I mean, but we didn't. We were in the highest part of the yard. Perhaps the ground is soft there. It's rocky. Then it might have been slippery. Well, I suppose. Suddenly he pressed closer to the window glass. Oh, damn. We've got a flat. What, Norman? A flat! Those are new tires, too. We must have picked up a nail on our way into the stupid place. Striding back to the bed, he caught her hand. Come on, I'm not leaving you this time. She did not protest. Obediently, she followed him downstairs and along the lower hall to the front door. On the piazza, she hesitated briefly, glancing back in what seemed to be a moment of panic. But when he again grasped her hand, she meekly went with him down the steps and out to the car. The left front tire was the flat one. Hunkering down beside it, he searched for the culprit nail but failed to find any. It was underneath, no doubt. Things like flat tires always annoyed him. In a properly organized world, they wouldn't happen. Of course, in such a world, there would not be the kind of road one had to travel to reach this place, nor would there be such an impossible house to begin with. Muttering to himself, he opened the trunk, extracted jack, tools, and spare, and went to work. Strange. There was no nail in the offending tire. No cut or bruise, either. The tire must have been badly made. The thought did not improve his mood, as on his knees he wrestled the spare into place. Then when he lowered the jack, the spare gently flattened under the car's weight, and he knelt there staring at it in disbelief. What the hell? Nothing like this had ever happened to him before. He jacked the car up again, took the spare off and examined it. No nail, no break, no bruise. It was a new tire, like the others. Newer because never yet used. He had a repair kit for tubeless tires in the trunk, he recalled. Bought one day on an impulse. Repair a puncture in minutes without even taking the tire off the car. But how could you repair a puncture that wasn't there? Linda, this is crazy. We'll have to walk back to town as we did before. He turned his head. Linda? She was not there. He lurched to his feet. Linda, where are you? How long had she been gone? He must have been working on the car for 15 or 20 minutes. She hadn't spoken in that time, he suddenly realized. Had she slipped back into the house the moment he became absorbed in his task? She knew well enough how intensely he concentrated on such things. How when he was writing, for instance, she could walk through the room without his even knowing it. Linda, for God's sakes, no! Hoarsely shouting her name, he stumbled towards the house. The door clattered open when he flung himself against it, and the sound filled his ears as he staggered down the hall. But now the hall was not just an ancient, dusty corridor. It was a dim tunnel, filled with premature darkness and strange whisperings. He knew where she must be, in that cursed room at the top of the stairs, where he had seen the look on her face 4 months ago, and where she had tried so cunningly to conceal the truth from him this time. But the room was hard to reach now. A swirling mist choked the staircase, repeatedly causing him to stumble. Things resembling hands darted out as if to clutch at him and hold him back. He stopped in confusion, and the hands nudged him forward again. Their owner was playing a game with him, he realized, mocking his frantic efforts to reach the bedroom, yet at the same time seductively urging him to try even harder. And the whisperings made words, or seemed to. Come, Norman. Sweet Norman. Come. 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 In the upstairs hall, too, the swirling mist challenged him, deepening into a moving mass that hid the door of the room. But he needed no compass to find that door. Gasping and cursing, damn you! Leave me alone! Get out of my way! He struggled to it and found it open as Linda and he had left it. Hands out thrust, he groped his way over the threshold. The alien presence here was stronger. The sense of being confronted by some unseen creature was all but overwhelming, yet the assault upon him was less violent now that he had reached the room. The hands groping for him in the eerie darkness were even gentle, caressing. They clung with a velvet softness that was strangely pleasurable, and there was something voluptuously female about them, even to a faint but pervasive female odor. An odor, not a perfume, a body scent, drug-like in its effect upon his senses. Bewildered, he ceased his struggle for a moment to see what would happen. The whispering became an invitation, a promise of incredible delights. But he allowed himself only a moment of listening and then, shouting Linda's name, hurled himself at the bed again. This time he was able to reach it. But she was not now sitting there, staring into that secret world of hers as he had expected. The bed was empty, and a seductive voice in the darkness softly laughed at his dismay. "Come, Norman. Sweet Norman, come, come, come." He felt himself taken from behind by the shoulders, turned, and ever so gently pushed. He fell floating into the old mattress, half-heartedly thrusting up his arms to keep the advancing shadow form from possessing him, but it flowed down over him, onto him, into him. Despite his feeble resistance and the female smell tantalized his senses again, destroying his will to resist. As he ceased struggling, he heard a sound of rusty hinges creaking in that part of the room's dimness where the door was, and then a soft thud. The door had been closed, but he did not cry out. He felt no alarm. It was good to be here on the bed, luxuriating in the sensuous, caressing softness. As he became quiescent, it flowed over him with unrestrained indulgence, touching and stroking him to heights of ecstasy. Now the unseen hands, having opened his shirt slowly and seductively, glided down his body to his belt. He heard a new sound then. For a moment it bewildered him, because, though coming through the ancient wall behind him, from the adjoining bedroom, it placed him at once in his own bedroom at home. Linda and he had joked about it often, as true lovers could, the explosive little syllables to which she always gave voice when making love. So she was content, too. Good. Everything was straightforward and above board then. After all, as that fellow at the club had suggested, mate swapping was an in thing in this year of our Lord 1975, wasn't it? All kinds of people did it. He must buy this house as Linda had insisted. Of course. She was absolutely right. With a sigh of happiness, he closed his eyes and relaxed, no longer made reluctant by a feeling of guilt. But something was wrong. Distinctly now, he felt not two hands caressing him, but more. And were they hands? They suddenly seemed cold, clammy, frighteningly eager. Opening his eyes, he was startled to find that the misty darkness had dissolved and he could see. Perhaps the seeing came with total surrender, or with a final abandonment of his guilt feeling. He lay on his back, naked, with his nameless partner, half beside him, half on him. He saw her scaly, misshapen breasts overflowing his chest, and her monstrous, demonic face swaying in space above his own. And as he screamed, he saw that she did have more than two hands. She had a whole writhing mass of them at the ends of long, searching tentacles. The last thing he saw before his scream became that of a madman was a row of three others, like her, squatting by the wall, their tentacles restlessly reaching towards him as they impatiently awaited their turn. White Moon Rising by Dennis Etchison. It went like this. In her room at the top of the stairs in the empty sorority house, she lay, warm and rumpled in her bed, trying hard to sleep some more. It was now near noon, and the light streaming through the open curtains had forced her wide awake. She did not seem to care if she ever got up. She had no classes, not for a week. Still, she could not make herself relax. The late morning flashed a granular red through her eyelids. Then she heard the front door down below open and close, the click echoing through the abandoned house like a garbage can dropped in an alley at dawn. Probably was one of the few remaining girls returning from an overnight date or to pick up books before leaving for vacation. Lisa hoped so. Now she could hear footsteps treading up the stairs. She tried to imagine who it was. The footsteps reached the top of the stairs and stopped. Firmly, deliberately, the footfalls turned and came down the hall toward her room. Maybe it was Sharon. She wanted it to be Sharon. She kept her eyes tightly closed. The shoes thumped deep into the rug. The loose board in the middle of the hall creaked. Finally, whoever it was reached her room. There, just on the other side of the door, Lisa felt ice crystals forming in her blood. She waited for the knock, for the clearing of a familiar throat, for the sound of her own name to come muffled through the door. But there was no sound. Still she waited. She held a breath. The blood pulsed coldly in her ears like a drum beaten underwater. She wanted to speak out. Then the sound of a hand on the loose doorknob and the almost imperceptible wing beat of the door gliding open. I know, she thought. I'll lie perfectly still. I won't let anything move in my body and I'll be safe. Whoever it is won't see me and will go away. Yes, she thought, that's what I'll have to do. Now she clearly felt a presence next to her bed. She was sure that someone was standing there in the doorway to her right, a hand probably still on the knob. She had not heard it rattle a second time. Time passed. She counted her heartbeats. At last she knew she could hold her breath no longer. She would have to do something very brave. With a rush that screamed adrenaline into her body, she sat bolt upright at the same instant, snapping her head to the right and unsticking her eyes with a pop. There was no one there. The door was still closed and locked. The room was empty. Suddenly she realized that her kidneys were throbbing in dull pain. She knew what that was. It was fear. The sunlight washed in through the window. "Oh, Joe," said his wife, "it makes me sick. Just physically ill, and I know it gets to you, too." Joe Mallory cleaned up the steak and eggs on his plate with a last swipe, then hesitated and let his fork mark a slow pattern through the smear of yolk that remained. "No," he cleared his throat, "no, honey. Just a job." Gently, he removed the newspaper from her side, poked it in half, and tried to find something else to read. "Joey," she said. She reached across the tablecloth suddenly and covered his hand. "I know you. And I know I shouldn't have let you take this job. Not this one." He looked up and was surprised and strangely moved to see her clear brown eyes glistening. As he forced his shoulders to shrug and his mouth to smile, she placed her other hand as well over his. From the open kitchen window sprang the sounds of bright chains of children on their way to the elementary school. He could almost see their black bowl haircuts and dirty feet. He wished he could help them, but it was already too late. He blinked, trying to concentrate. "Baby," said calmly, resurrecting a pet name they had abandoned before he went overseas. "One more semester, and I'm finished with night classes. Look, you know the size of the government checks, and you know they aren't going to get any bigger. We both know Ray can't take me on without a degree." "You know he would, Joey, if you ask him again. What's a brother for?" Instantly, she darkened, regretting the last. She held his hand, hoping that he would let it pass. "Now, let me finish," he said slowly. "I can't handle a position like that yet. Not without leaning on someone half the time. I have to do it, right? This damn uniform is just a job until I'm ready. Till then? Well, what else do I know, really, now?" He flipped her hands over and warmed them with his. "I have to make things right before I go ahead. To feel like I'm my own man. I thought you understood that." "Oh, I know all that. I'm sorry. I know. It was just all the details, the whole horrible things. These last few weeks, it sounds so awful." She rested her forehead on her arm and cried for a few seconds. Then she pressed her nose and stood up, stacking the dishes. "Come on, you big jock. You'll be late." He pushed away from the table and crossed the kitchen in three steps. He took his wife in his arms and held her close for a long minute, while the electric clock hummed high and white on the wall. She walked back and forth with his body. Finally, she began to laugh. "Get out of here," she said, trying hard. "Meet me at work," he said. "I'll take you to Fernando's for dinner." The tears settled, diamond bright in her eyes. She kissed him noisily and pushed him out the door. She watched him through the window. He came back in. "Forgot something," he said. He walked briskly to the breakfast table, picked up the morning paper and dropped it in the waste can. "Give my love to the ice cream man," he said before he shut the door again. "Hey, I don't even know the..." He was gone, and she stopped laughing. She went to the can and picked out the paper. She spread it on the table and stared down at it. "Jesus," she said very seriously. "Oh, Jesus, Joe." The latest headline read, "Security doubled. Another brutal COVID slaying." Lisa, now in tank top and embroidered Levi's, toed into her sandals and slipped down the stairs, her thin fingers playing lightly over the handrail. "Sharon?" On the wall at the foot of the stairs, she noticed the poster Sharon had brought with her from New York. It was one of those old "you don't have to be Jewish to love Levi's" advertisements, showing an Indian biting into a slice of rye bread. Sharon had replaced the Indian with a horribly burned face of an Asian child, and now she saw that someone had written across the face with the red marking pen the words, "You don't have to be a unicorn to enjoy the tapestry," in an unmistakably feminine hand. She wondered what that meant. "Has anybody seen Sharon?" she called, tapping her nails on the railing. Then, "Is anybody here?" She thought she heard voices and stepped off the stairs, but she saw only the bright, still day outside the open front door and the two familiar security guards at the edge of the dry lawn. They stood with their hands behind their backs, and Lisa thought, peculiar smiles on their faces as they walked on their heels, their billy clubs swung tautly from wide black belts. Something about them gave her the creeps. Her eyes listlessly scanned the living room, finding nothing to settle on. She stepped away from the open front door. Sharon must have left it open, on the way out, probably to see Elliot. She could call Elliot and find out, couldn't she? She took two steps towards the phone. She stopped. The thought of the newly installed tap put her off again. "Damn it," she thought. "It irks me, just the idea of it. It really does." She sighed. She stood in the middle of the rug, her left hand resting on the back of the sofa and her right hand fingering her left elbow. She took a breath, held it, let it out. Then she went over to the big front door and nudged it shut. With her back, she didn't particularly want to look inside. Officer William W. Williams was doing push-ups on the grass. "How many I got, John?" 47 by my count, Bill." "You lying?" "You're not going to break no record today, Williams," said Officer Hall around the lumpy chili dog from the food service machines. "You shut up, Hal," Williams spat to one side and pumped three more times. The muscles on his shining arms inflated with each stroke. 50, said Joe matter-of-factly, "and still counting." Williams quivered high on his corded arms for a beat, then dipped again. "Mother," he breathed. The sun, setting some kind of record for April, beat down in shimmering waves now mercifully on the tin roof of the pergola so that the officers were able to remove their spongy hats, at least for half an hour. Joe felt not quite a breeze, but at least a shift in the hovering air layers here in the shade. The sweat in his short black hair was beginning to evaporate, cooling and contracting his scalp. It was, he thought, without knowing why, a day for ice cream. Williams, however, chose to remain under the sun, bridging again and again over the blanched grass. "What did the chief have to say this morning?" asked Joe. "Sorry I missed the briefing." The men did not answer. As far as Joe could see, the campus was deserted. The gray buildings flat and silent, the sparsely sown trees moving not at all in the noonday heat. Though he knew better, Joe wondered idly if anyone other than security was on the grounds today. Old John, white-haired and better suited to a Santa Claus costume than a black uniform, folded his hands unsteadily. It was another one of his pep talks, Joe. "You know Withers." Joe didn't very well, but it didn't matter. "I guess you didn't miss anything." Hall resumed chewing. Joe realized that Williams had suspended over the lawn. Finally, he moved down. "Well, I hope we get him," offered Joe, "and soon. A guy like that has got to be sick and needs help." "Up," Williams stopped. Hal stopped eating. Joe felt odd. He repeated to himself what he had said, trying to figure out why they were uptight. Something about Withers, maybe? Except for old John, they didn't seem to like the chief. That must be it. "Hal," said Hall, "this is the easiest job in the world. We don't have to do anything. A person commits a violation. He does himself in." He spoke carefully as if laying on a scientific fact. "Because if he's human, he's ashamed of the act. That's all the lever we need." Barely changing his tone, he said, "Look at that one, will you?" They looked. A young girl, slender and poised, was crossing the parking lot in old Levi's, very tight, and a form-fitting top. Down. "Whew, that one is sweet and tough," said William. "Up." "You take girls like that," Hall went on. "They don't have any sense of shame. Man, somebody's got to teach her a lesson." "I'm not sure I follow you," said Joe. "Down." Williams rolled over onto his back. "Give me some of that Dr. Pepper." Hall cackled and took the bottle over to Williams. He knelt and whispered something. Williams nodded, then drained the bottle and lay back, gazing dreamily through the low trees by the pergola. "Somebody give me my shirt and gun." He sang a few notes to himself. "You know what we need around here?" he asked. "Bows and arrows. That's what we had in Nam. Pick a sentry out of a tree at 100 yards. Whoosh! Simple as that. Don't make no noise." The girl was disappearing from sight. "What time it's getting to be?" asked Joe. He reached for his walkie-talkie. "We'd better check in with a command post." "No reason to hurry," said Hall. Williams rolled over onto his belly. "Up." He started counting again. "Down. Up. Down." "Hey, you can knock it off," Hall said to him. "She's gone." They all had a good laugh over that. Lisa, walking across the grass. What were they laughing about? Beyond the glimmering parking lot, she glanced over her shoulder at the pergola, blurry without her glasses, bouncing behind her with each step. She shrugged and went on. She looked down. She slipped her shoes off and felt the warm grass following her feet past the library and the new student union, staying on the shade. At the far side of the campus, she climbed the cool steps to the lab. "Knock, knock." She slid around the open door. The stink from the tiered cages was overpowering. She knew at once that it would be too much for her. She heard someone clear his throat. She held her breath, tucked in her top, and walked forward between the skittering enclosures. Oh, an electric buzz rattled the cages. The rats scrambled over one another, hundreds and hundreds of rats. She almost screamed. The buzzing stopped. The rats subsided. A hand, cold and clammy as sweating brass, touched her neck. She stiffened. It seemed to be trying to press her straight down into the floor. "Ah, but you're not Sherry, are you?" It was a statement. "Apologies." She was released. She turned. She saw Moy's left hand, recently relieved of its rubber glove. As she faced it, an acrid fume sliced up her nostrils. Formaldehyde. She stumbled back. "Well, hi, Elliot. I was looking for Sharon." She rubbed at her watering eyes. "I was on my way to your apartment, but I thought I'd stop by here first." She looked up into his pallid, implacable face and shuddered. "You haven't seen her?" "Afraid not, Lisa." He simply observed her, waiting. She wanted out, but she said, "Well, what are you up to in here anyway? I never saw these mice the last time I was here." He snapped off his right glove and moved to the sink, applied talc. He pocketed his pale hands in his white coat and leaned against the supply cabinet. "A low voltage is discharged through the bottom of each cage," said Elliot. "Every 2 minutes, 24 hours a day, at various stages, I remove typical specimens and dissect the adrenal cortex, the thymus, the spleen, the lymph nodes, and so forth, and of course the stomach. There is a definite syndrome, you know." "Are you for real?" she wondered, drifting to the window. Below, a fat, greasy-looking mama's boy with horn-rimmed glasses gazed up at the window. She had seen him hanging around a number of times lately. Too many times. She stepped away from the window. "The adrenal cortex," continued Elliot conversationally, "is always enlarged. All the lymphatic structures are shrunken, and there are deep ulcers usually in the stomach and upper gut. He's not kidding, she thought. She looked outside again. The young man was gone. She felt relieved. What do you call it? She said, almost reflexively. A stress rig, said Elliot. Cheerfully, she thought. Then, Sherry's probably back at the house by now. Be careful going home, will you? I know I don't need to remind you. When she did not say anything about what happened to the others, it was a combination. A chokehold from behind, forearm across the throat under the chin, one arm in a hammerlock, fractures of the larynx, internal hemorrhaging in this vertebrae, this one right here at the base of the neck. That's what finished them. He had to lift them off their feet. Here, he reached out to show her. Suddenly, jarringly, the cages buzzed. Let me out of here, she felt sick. Well, I'll see you later, Elliot, she said, not waiting for an answer. Outside and down the stairs, a breeze was coming in with the dusk. It's really summer, she thought. She wanted desperately to be at the beach. She could almost smell the sea and ski basting her skin. A bird sang high on a telephone wire. Oh, let there always be summers, she thought. 100, 1,000 of them. That was what she wanted. She wanted there to be 1,000 summers. Joe trod blankly along the university drive. Off duty at last, he was on his way back to the campus, where his wife would be waiting. How long has this been happening? He asked, a little dazed. Ed Withers been paying off Hall to keep him quiet ever since. Lord, 7, 8 months, said old John, strolling with his hands behind his back, his voice low as a moribund bulldog's. Anyway, Joey, he had never called him that before. I figured you ought to know. What I mean to get across is, try to keep to yourself as much as you can while you're here. They're kind of, they're a bunch of what you would call motivated young officers. Highly motivated. What I can't understand, Joe persisted, is why everyone is keeping his mouth shut. Old John averted his eyes and took an unexpected number of steps to answer. He fingered his handcuffs nervously. They glinted in the day's dying rays of sunlight. Job's a job, you know what I mean, muttered old John. Joe turned those words over and over as they came to Portola Place. What in the world did that have to do with it? He stopped at the curb. What does that have to do with it? He asked. But old John was trekking on down Portola Place. He continued to keep an eye on Joe, however. Joe saw him put a hand behind his ear. Nothing, Joe shouted. Nothing at all. See you Friday. He shook his head. Even here, he thought. He took a too deep breath of the lukewarm air, squinting at the setting sun peeped in his staring red eye from between the buildings. He started walking again. He lowered his head and watched his feet move crossing the street at a fast clip. So Hall's wife was getting pumped by the chief of security, and Chief Withers was there a less melodramatic word for it, blackmailed by Hall, with a promotion thrown in? Joe throttled a bitter laugh. He wondered whether Hall's wife knew that end of it, and whether she was smugly enjoying the benefits with her husband. What the hell? What the hell? What the hell? Joe thought aimlessly and heard a rustling in the bushes. Where's the cook? She's not coming in again till after vacation. Well, where's the house mother? Said Kathy. I know, there's no house mother here. Oh, I wish I was still a PT. Better not let Madam President hear you, said Sharon. She'll kick you out on your ass. Kathy groaned and went upstairs. Lisa laughed. She had seen the house mother for Pye Towse. Her face had more lines in it than War and Peace, which she had been reading for English 260. Trying to read. Part one had been on the 6 o'clock movie, Monday. Dutifully, she had watched it, but for some reason, she had to miss part two. Part three had been on for a few minutes now. Henry Fonda is the only one who acts like he read the book, said Sharon, giving up on the color controls and laying her legs over the arm of the couch again. The set, which rendered everything the color of bile, did look, as Sharon had once remarked, like somebody took a whiz on it. Lisa tried to follow the plot, but by now it made no sense at all to her. "Who's been leeching my Marlboros anyway?" said Sharon, digging under the cushions. Lisa flipped over to Channel 11. "Hey, chiller's on." "Right arm," said Sharon. "Is that Frankenstein?" "Not again," said Sharon. "I've seen this flick so many. You know, I've never seen it all the way through," said Lisa. "My folks would never let me."
"Ha!"
"No, really." "Well, go ahead, knock yourself out." Fascinated, Lisa watched the scene in which little Maria so innocently shared her flowers with a monster in the riverbank. One by delicate one, they cast daisies on the water. Then very slowly the monster's expression began to change as the child ran out of flowers, as the scene began to fade out. "That's the part they always cut," said Sharon. "You just see this face right after this, before they find her with her neck broken. You know what I think? I don't believe he even meant to kill her at all. I think he just sort of, you know, crushed her to him. You know what I mean? I don't think there was anything evil about it. They were both innocents. Neither one of them knew anything about it." A bald-headed used car salesman appeared on the screen, his face a sneer of chartreuse. Joe stood stock still and waited for the next sound. It did not come. He stepped into the blue-shadowed lawn, his hand steadied on his flashlight. He heard footfalls on the other side of the hedge, close to a house. He let himself into the foliage, deciding to follow it up. Leaves small and shiny tracked past him on either side, hard branches skidding off his head, almost knocking his hat to the ground. Close to the other side, he saw a man's back moving quickly away from him along the side of the house towards the front sidewalk. The house was dark, probably empty. He hoped so. He felt disoriented for a fraction of a second, almost as if he were not really here but somewhere else entirely. Then he saw the figure stand straight and slow to a normal gait, crossing under the street lamp. Then the figure returned to a crouch and headed into the trees on the other side. Peeping Tom? Or the one he had been hired to catch? Well, if this is the one, he must be one poor scared son of a bitch right now. Even if he doesn't know it, he's being watched. In fact, Joe realized, his own heart hammering at the back of his badge, that part wouldn't really have anything to do with the feeling. Not anything at all. Joe pulled free of the hedge and backed up. He moved down behind the next four houses in line and then continued forward to the street and crossed at the end of the block. He cut into the alley just past the houses. He stood close to the wooden fence, navigating around trash barrels. Empty. They would drum an alarm down the whole of Sorority Row. He heard tennis shoes grinding into the gravel. A young man crossed the alley not 50 feet in front of him. They heard Kathy put a record on the turntable upstairs. The TV screen receded into the deepening shadows of the living room. A cricket started up, sounding so close that Lisa glanced nervously about to see if it was in the house with them. Outside, an elderly officer paced past the hedge, hands behind his back. "Look at that old codger," Sharon's ash flared and hissed before her face, then arced down. "I'll bet they still don't give them real bullets to use." "Yeah, I saw his gun one time. The barrel was plugged up with wood or bubblegum or something. I wonder if they're going to do any good now that we need them." "Somebody needs them. The only thing they've been good for so far is to remind us all. Do you see what I mean?" She sat forward. "God, I've got to get away from here for a while. I'm starting to vegetate. When's Elliot coming over?" "He didn't say." "He always takes his time. I don't know what he does on his way over here. Wandering around, jacking his brain off with some new pet theory."
"Sharon!"
"Well, it's the truth." They sat with the sound turned down. The cricket synced with the record for a few bars, then continued on its own again.
"Can I have one of those, please?"
"I didn't know you were smoking now, Lise."
"I'm not. Not really."
The young man crossed the alley. Joe froze. Then he followed. Passing between two houses, he stopped again and dropped to one knee. He saw ahead to the next street. The young man had already crossed over and was now hesitating by one of the huts on the other side. Houses, he told himself. Now Joe looked between the trees and houses as down a tunnel, as the street lamp flicked on, the pavement mottled under the new light. His eyes focused through to a square of still bright sky visible now above the long campus parking lot. He waited. Another figure, nearly a silhouette, appeared against the sky. It was a woman. He snapped to, aware that he had lost track of his prey. The young man was gone. He had slipped through probably to the lot. But had he gone through? Or was he still somewhere on the block between, sidestepping from house to house? He had blown it. He started to move away. Then it hit him. The woman. The woman waiting in the lot. It had to be his wife. Elliot, said Sharon, is very into it, and therefore out of it, if you know what I mean. There are moments with us, not many, but there are. You are right, though. Sometimes I do wonder if it's worth it. God, I've been staring into this box too long. Now it's beginning to stare back. She clicked off the TV with her toe. I don't need to turn on the tube to see rape, murder, and perversion. I can get all that right here at school. Lisa heard a record droning upstairs. It sounded like Dylan. Turn, turn, turn again. Tell her to turn it over, will you? Said Sharon. That song's bumming me out. Lisa felt her way to the top of the first landing. Lisa, bring down something to scarf, will you? Screaming yellow zonkers, whatever she's got hidden up there, anything. Lisa smiled. Turn, turn, turn to the rain and the wind. She walked on down the hall. Joe had squatted so long that his gaze was fixed, almost as if the rectangle of light sky had somehow been looking back down into him instead. His eyes stung. Fatigue. He hoped 4 days a week had seemed fine at first. Enough time to do some good, maybe, but not enough to. But it was late now, much later than he had thought, judging by the color of the sky. Marlene, he realized, blinking alert, had been waiting. How long? How long had he crouched here? And how long before, at the other village? Block, he reminded himself, block. He crossed the street, his breath jangling in his ears like dog tags. He shot a glance at the patch of sky and the dark figure of his wife. His pace quickened. As he headed over a lawn, a young man bolted out of the shrubs, a pair of horn-rimmed glasses clattering from his face. With Ritz crackers and a 5-pack of Hydrox cookies in one hand, she drew the knob towards her, cutting the sliver of light from Kathy's room, and made for the stairs. There was a knock on the front door. The stairway was an unknown in the dark. She waited. Finally, Sharon, can you get that? The knock again. She descended, pressing against the wall. She felt a catch in her throat. Why? The door swung open. The kid was squirming on the lawn, his face jumping. What's the matter? I'm on my way home from a study date. What's the matter? Joe closed the cuffs, pressed the key into the notch, and set the lock. Something in the young man's face, swarming in a film of sweat, refused to let Joe relax. He shoved the glasses at him and pulled him to his feet. He glanced ahead. The sky was dark, too dark to see her. He whipped up the antennas on his walkie-talkie. It shook in his hands, waving back and forth in the night air. She saw a woman backlight in the open doorway. I'm sorry, said the woman, but I wonder if you've seen my husband. He was supposed to meet... No, I stammered, Lisa. Do you mean he was outside? Where was Sharon? Where? She left the doorway. Just a minute, okay? She felt around the room. Cher? She called. I know, she thought. She was hungry. I'll check the kitchen. If I can only find the light. Sharon, she called and wondered why her voice was breaking. We don't want to hurt you, Joe said. Believe that. He drew his prisoner through the shrubs, crushing twigs and unseen garden creatures in his path. He turned up the gain and depressed the call button. He needed backup. His throat was dry and the back of his tongue hurt. A shrill electronic sound whined close by. Instantly, he recognized it. It was feedback, his own signal being picked up on another receiver. "I guess you wouldn't know who I mean," the woman said from the doorway. "But he's one of the security." It's so dark, thought Lisa at the door to the kitchen. She forced herself across the chill linoleum, her arms outstretched like antennae. She heard a sound, a low voice. It was singing. Some folks like to talk about it, some don't. A wind from nowhere blew through her chest. He pushed the kid ahead of him, following the sound, louder. Joe was relieved. Reinforcements were near. Then he noticed his prisoner stare. At the rear of the last house, the parking lot, dark shapes were moving. She seemed to swim through darkness past the smooth, pulsating refrigerator where there were always tooth marks in the cheese, to the drawer from which the tools had been quietly disappearing for weeks, clamoring for something, anything with which to protect herself. It was silly, she knew, but there, a butcher knife. Joe released his own wrist and locked the kid to the branch of what might have been a rubber tree. "We'll be back for you, Charlie," he said. She felt herself drawn down the short stone steps from the kitchen to the storage porch, to the low singing and other voices, and what sounded like a scratching close to the screen door that opened into the backyard. The officer plunges through the shrubbery. At that, someone slams out the back door, sees dark forms in the girl held to the dirt, and reflexively cocks back an arm, white moons rising on the nails that clench the knife. The officer sees the downed girl, uniforms, another figure lunging into it. There is no time to question, not now, while there is still time to stop it, before it happens again. He remembers them sitting there dumbly in their baggy pajamas, their wooden bowls empty of the ice cream a few minutes before it happened, and how he had gone away and done nothing, not even when he heard the laughter and the grunting and the automatic fire and the screams, but not this time. He dodges and grabs the empty hand, wrenching it into a hammerlock as he encircles the waist with his left arm, releasing the wrist with his right and setting his forearm under the chin. The back arches and the legs kick madly, but the hand refuses to let go the knife. Faces turn up. One of the officers stays atop their victim. It is Williams, who closes in from the front, spreading his milky palm across the distorted mouth, covering it. "Nice going, Joe," he grins. "Now you're one of us, too." Joe does not yet understand. Now he feels a slip in the neck, and the body swings like the clapper of a bell in his arms. Now he hears new footsteps behind him, and a sudden skull-splitting screech. It is a scream of a woman. He thinks he recognizes it, but it's too late. Not really is too late, as the girl in his arms swings one last anguished time, as her knife slices at the dark with a flash, and he sees a face reflected in the blade for an instant before it drops into the leaves. But he must know what he has seen. He has seen the face of a killer. It is the same face he has always seen. The moonlight washes down on them all.